It's to the best of our knowledge. Do you ever have trouble sleeping? Steve Paulson does.
I'm not a great sleeper to begin with, but there was a period that lasted probably about 5 months where it was awful. I really wondered if I would ever be able to have a regular night of sleep again without a pill. As the night approached, I would start getting really anxious because I would think, I'm not going to be able to fall asleep. If I did manage to fall asleep, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I couldn't get back to sleep. I was so anxious that I couldn't lie in bed. I had to get up, literally pace around the house. There was this one period where actually I would get up at 2 or 3 in the morning and go on the exercise bike. And I would just pedal for a half an hour, trying to wear myself into sleep. It was this weird combination of being totally wired and totally exhausted. I wasn't sure if I was ever going to be able to sleep again. As this dragged on, the insomnia, it affected my mood. I got depressed. I could just feel my whole mood sinking. The worst nights, it was like my shadow self came out. Everything that was negative in my head just came crashing into my mind. And you know, I felt worthless. It was hard. It was, I don't know, a little scary. I would take a sleeping pill every so often when I just needed to have a decent night's sleep, but I really tried to avoid that. I just was so worried about becoming dependent. I tried other things, essential oils. I started dabbing this one oil on my forehead and another oil on the bottom of my feet every night before I'd go to bed. It was like, you know, sleeping in a forest, a scented forest at that point. I went to see a cognitive behavioral therapist. He had a few practical suggestions. Cut down on my coffee, cut down on my alcohol consumption. He suggested a meditation app, and that was good. Every so often, he'd say this one thing that he'd say, you know, your body really wants to sleep. Because it didn't feel that way at all to me, but I would just hang on to his words if there was any kind of note of consolation. Eventually, I went to see an acupuncturist, and I think that was the thing more than anything else that helped. Or at least I thought it helped. Whatever happened, that seemed to help. And eventually, I learned to sleep again. It felt like a miracle. My guess is that I'll never be a great sleeper. You know, wake up periodically during the night. Normally, I fall back asleep, but every so often there's something that's in the back of my head thinking, you know, I'm not going to be able to sleep, and that's when the cycle can start again.
That's our executive producer, Steve Paulson. I'm Anne Strange Champs, and as most of you know, I'm also Steve's wife. When he's tossing and turning, I'm on the other side of the bed. So I know this story all too well. And maybe you do too. Health officials say insomnia has reached epidemic proportions. An estimated 1/3 of the country, 1 in 3 of us, doesn't get enough sleep. How can something so simple be so hard? And for so many people?
Well, actually, in medical school, we get taught very, very little about sleep. In fact, during my medical schooling, I don't think that I had a single lecture, a single seminar related to sleep.
Today, Guy Leschsener is a sleep physician. He runs one of the largest sleep clinics in Europe, where he specializes in bizarre conditions, like nocturnal hallucination, sleep paralysis, sleep eating, and something called sexsomnia. You don't want to know. He told Steve about the moment he first realized how much sleep matters.
I think I was 19 at the time. I'd always presumed that the function of sleep was to make you feel less sleepy.
Right.
I hadn't really analyzed it before that. And I came across a paper that was written by Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the structure of DNA, theorizing as to the functions of dreaming, of REM sleep. And it suddenly dawned on me, oh my God, sleep is not just about making you feel less tired. There's a whole range of activities that the brain goes through that are involved in pretty much every aspect of our waking lives. And it was really through that that I became more and more fascinated with sleep.
Interesting. I have personally really struggled with insomnia over the years. And the thing that I have often wondered is, how much of my problem is psychological, you know, when I get into my head that I just cannot fall asleep, and how much is physiological when my body just seems all revved up when I think I should be getting sleepy? And I'm wondering if you can generalize at all about this question.
So we think of insomnia as really being a learnt habit, in that we associate on a conscious and an unconscious level bed with sleeping. But if we've had issues with our sleep for any prolonged period of time and we have a predisposition to insomnia, be that genetic or personality or a range of other things, then those positive associations that we have between the sleeping environment and sleep are replaced with negative associations.
Which I know very well, yes.
Yeah. But we also know that after a while of very poor sleep, there are some hormonal changes that occur. So levels of a hormone called cortisol, which is a stress response hormone, or adrenaline are actually upregulated. And both those hormones are very conducive to insomnia. And so people tend to get into this slight vicious cycle whereby the psychological factors initiate the problem with sleep. But then subsequently, physiological factors make sleep even more difficult and exacerbate the psychological factors.
That sounds extremely familiar to me, yes. So what is a normal night of sleep? Because there are certain stages of a typical night of sleep, aren't there?
Yes, for the average adult, we typically go through 4 or 5 cycles of the different stages of sleep. And we tend to divide sleep into what's termed REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And this is the stage of sleep during which we have these dreams of a narrative structure. During this stage of sleep, we are paralyzed. The only muscles that work are really the muscles that allow us to breathe and the muscles that move our eyes back and forward. And when we look at the brain using electrodes, scalp electrodes, to understand the underlying electrical activity of the brain, it actually looks rather like it does during wakefulness. In the other stages of sleep that we term non-REM sleep, the brain slows down, the brain waves become larger and slower, and it seems to be a very different state to REM sleep. So we tend to do most of our deep sleep, deep non-REM sleep, in the first half of the night, and most of our REM sleep, our dreaming sleep, in the latter half of the night. And so we cycle between these stages of REM and non-REM sleep about every 90 minutes or so over the course of the night.
Now, you've said that under normal circumstances, our body is paralyzed during sleep, except for our eyes, the rapid eye movement.
During REM sleep.
During REM sleep. But there are some exceptions. And some of those people end up in your sleep clinic, and you tell some remarkable stories. One is about a patient of yours named Jackie who would get on her motorbike during the night and go out in sleep. Could you just sort of tell her story? Because it's just pretty dramatic.
Yeah. Jackie was brought up in Canada. And when she was a young girl in the Girl Guides, she would be taken into the forests of northern Canada for camping trips. And it became very obvious that she was doing odd things in the night because she would be woken up by all the girls in her tent screaming because she would be growling like a bear in the middle of the night. She was soon sent home after that. And then over the course of her young years, she continued to have sleepwalking events. But it was when she moved back to the UK and was lodging with a woman that one morning the landlady said to her, "Well, where did you go last night?" And she said, "Well, what are you talking about? I didn't go anywhere." And the landlady said to her, "Well, I saw you coming down the stairs with your helmet in your hand, and then I heard your motorbike start up, and you went off to come back 20 minutes later." And Jackie had absolutely no recall of this whatsoever. She was totally mystified. Over the course of the next few weeks, it became apparent that actually she was taking her motorbike out in the middle of the night and riding through the streets of the local town. Soon after that, she sold her motorbike for fear of actually doing this.
Right.
But later on in life, in fact, when I met her, she was already in her 60s. She had an incident whereby her neighbours in the block of apartments that she was living in said, "Oh, where did you drive at 1 o'clock in the morning?" And once again, she was totally astonished and said, "Well, you know, what are you talking about? I was in bed. I was fast asleep." And they were very insistent and said, "No, we saw you driving out of the garage under the block of flats and you drove off in the direction of the seafront. And then we went to bed. We waved at you, but you didn't wave back." It became very apparent that actually she was then taking her car out in the middle of the night and driving around.
Which sounds absolutely terrifying. So how did she deal with this? I mean, did she find a remedy?
Actually, even before she met me, she had worked out a very good way of trying to treat herself, which is she bought a time-locked safe and put her car keys in that safe so she couldn't get access to her car keys before 7 o'clock in the morning, which was a very effective treatment. And in the end, actually, we didn't need to give her any treatment because this had been part and parcel of her life for as long as she could remember. And really what she wanted was just to make sure that she was safe and that the people living in her town were safe. So she found her own solution.
It sounds like you're saying that for some people, it's possible to be both asleep and awake at the same time.
Absolutely. I've seen people sleep cook, jump out of the way of helicopters in the middle of the night, really quite dramatic. And in fact, there have been a number of cases of individuals who've performed criminal acts in the middle of the night. I describe one patient in my book who was convicted of rape as a result of a condition called sexsomnia. And there have been some very famous cases in, particularly in North America, where individuals have killed somebody in the middle of the night, and these have been found to be related to these parasomnias.
Wow. So it sounds like for some people, I assume a complete change of personality during the night. I mean, maybe they're totally peace-loving, gentle people during their waking hours, and then the demons come out at night in sleep.
Indeed. We used to think of the brain as being in one single state of sleep or wake at a time, so that sleep was a global brain state. What we now understand is that that's very much not the case. In fact, even whilst we're awake, there are very small areas of the cerebral cortex, the outer lining of the brain, that are constantly dipping in and out of sleep, and that's termed local sleep. But we also know that local sleep can occur at night. Certain parts of the brain can remain in very deep sleep, whilst other parts of the brain demonstrate waking behaviour. And the areas of the brain that seem to remain in very deep sleep are the frontal lobes, which is really where our reasoning, where our rational thinking resides, and an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is where our memory is deposited. And so one can really think of this as being a form of transient brain dysfunction. The brain is not working normally because parts of the brain are shut down.
Now, you have these other stories that are also astonishing. For instance, a young man named Vincent, whose internal body clock was all out of whack. Tell me about him.
So Vincent is a young boy who, when I first met him, was 16. And he had an operation in his early teenage years. And after this operation, he noted that he was starting to be asleep during the day and awake at night. And actually, when questioned a little bit more closely, what he was describing was that every day he would go to bed 1 hour later and wake up 1 hour later. So over the course of a 24, 25-day period, he would essentially cycle right the way round the clock. So for about 1 week a month, he would be in sync with the world around him. He would be able to go to school and function, socialize. But for the rest of the time, he would be totally out of kilter with the world around him. And as a result, his schoolwork suffered terribly. His attendance at school was very poor. He began to have major difficulties with his social life, and it really destroyed his life.
So what do you do? How did you treat Vincent?
Well, I think with Vincent, it's been very difficult indeed. We try and manipulate the clock using melatonin, which is appropriately timed, and bright light therapy, which sometimes helps entrain the circadian rhythm. And actually, during the summer, his body clock is a little easier to regulate because there is all this environmental light. But in the winter, it's much more difficult.
As you're talking about all of these different kinds of sleep issues, it strikes me that we still don't know a whole lot about how sleep works. Are we still in early stages of the science of sleep?
I think that, obviously, sleep science has moved forward tremendously over the last 20 years or so. We have amazing tools at our disposal to peer into the depths of the brain. But this work takes time, and it also requires us to be able to track sleep accurately in the long term rather than just on a night-by-night basis. So there is still so much to learn, and that's part of the excitement of it.
Well, this whole conversation has been so fascinating, and it hits home for me too. So anyway, thank you so much.
Okay, pleasant dreams.
Yes.
That's neurologist Guy Leschziner talking with Steve Paulson. Guy is the presenter for the BBC radio series called Mysteries of Sleep, and he's the author of The Nocturnal Brain. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. There is nothing fun about lying awake at 3 a.m. But what if instead of fighting it, you tried to embrace sleeplessness? Writer Marina Benjamin did and wound up writing one of the most lyrical books about insomnia I've ever read. It begins like this. When I am up at night, the world takes on a different hue. It is quieter and closer. And there are textures of the dark I have begun paying attention to. I register the thickening, sense-dulling darkness that hangs velvety as a pall over deep night, and the green-black tincture you get when moisture charges the atmosphere with static, and the gently shifting penumbra that heralds dawn, In sleeplessness, I have come to understand that there is a taxonomy of darkness to uncover, and with it, a nocturnal literacy we can acquire. Nocturnal literacy. I love that notion. Tell me more. What is it to you?
Well, I suppose it began for me spending so much time awake at night. I began to pay attention to my environment a bit more. So part of the nocturnal literacy that I'm referring to is an acquaintance with the sounds and the feel of the night and the animals that are nocturnal who are awake when you are, the blue light from my computer, the kind of muzzy light from the street lights, the noises of the night, thinking about who's awake at night, bin men, bakers, police, the sirens blaring. I suppose it's because I'm in an urban landscape, it's the urban soundscape that is my nocturnal reality, but I imagine it's very different for people who live in the countryside.
Well, I love the idea of paying such close attention because one thing reading your book taught me is there are so many kinds of insomnia. It began to seem sort of ridiculous to me that we have just this blanket term, insomnia, for an experience that can be so varied. So what's your personal relationship with insomnia? How long have you had it?
Well, I've known it all my life, really, but it's changed over time. I think many people will recognize what I experienced in childhood if I say that my childhood sleeplessness was much more a fear and a refusal of sleep than an inability to sleep. I just didn't want my consciousness to be blanked out by the dark.
Were you afraid of nightmares?
It was more that I wanted the day to continue, that I wanted the adventures and the play and the activity and the brightness of day and consciousness never to go away.
But then that changed?
Yeah. It became an inability to sleep. It felt more constitutional. I felt more defeated by an inability to sleep.
You know, when I have insomnia, and you know, we're talking about a middle-aged person's insomnia, it usually means lying awake, obsessively worrying.
Yes.
My mind feels like a gerbil on a wheel. I'm just kind of racing through this rather boring litany of anxieties over and over again.
I think at one point I referred to it as a kind of drip, 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 like waterboarding your mind.
Yes, exactly.
With an endless surplus of excessive and irrelevant thinking.
Yeah, as though you're trapped in the dark with yourself.
Absolutely. You are, because you have to confront yourself in insomnia, you are never more present than when you were awake at night. And actually, the opposite for the sleeping person is they are never more absent. They are a husk, a shell.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating paradox. This thing that we long for, right? We love and long for sleep, and yet we can't ever experience it. You can't witness your own sleep. So what is this thing that we long for?
Oblivion. Release from our own minds. From the tyranny of consciousness.
Yeah. You have this passage when you talk about sleep and love. What do you write? When you cannot get sleep, you fall in love with sleep. And I was thinking about how much we long for it and how there is something almost rapturous, kind of voluptuous about getting into bed at the end of a really long day when you're exhausted.
Every insomniac I kind of fantasizes about beds, about being horizontal, about rest. One friend of mine, when she can't sleep at night, looks at what I call soft furnishings porn. Endless pictures of beautifully made up beds with fantastic bedspreads and swags of material and goose down feathers. And it's that ineffable link, really, between lacking and longing. When you don't have something, the more you don't have it, the more you want it.
Does looking at the pictures of beautiful beds help her fall asleep?
It does for her. It does it for her.
I'll have to try that next time. That makes me think about enchanted sleep. It's something else you write about, because those sound like fairy tale beds. I was surprised how many fairy tales do have some kind of enchanted sleep in them.
Although in many fairy tales, the sleep is cursed. Rather than a kind of restful sleep, it's a sleep of the dead.
Oh, that's right. Sleeping Beauty, for instance. She pricks her finger on the spindle and falls into the 100 years sleep.
That's right. It's very interesting how that association between sleep and beautiful women as well was another thing that interested me, this idea of this kind of enchanted, but in fact, supremely passive sleep The more I read about it, the more I thought enchanted sleep was a kind of con, especially for women, a sort of enforced passivity, a negation of their actual agency. And I started exploring kind of the prevalence, particularly in the 19th century painting and 19th century thinking, of what the sleeping woman symbolized. The Pre-Raphaelites, for example, for about the second half of the 19th century, were endlessly painting sleeping women.
Well, that's interesting because the 19th century was a time of social change and women were just beginning to emerge as more autonomous. A few more women began to have careers, for instance. Maybe this was a kind of subtle pushback.
Well, it's very interesting you raise this idea of kind of female agency and how it was viewed when women dared to kind of assert themselves in the public sphere or want a profession or want to write or paint or teach. If at any point they expressed the strain of having to fight their way into public life, they often developed nervous conditions, and these nervous conditions were treated by bed rest.
Something called the rest cure, right?
Yeah, the rest cure. So the American physician Silas Weir Mitchell started working with women who were showing stress from having their ambitions, their worldly ambitions, frustrated. And what he came up with was the rest cure. And the rest cure involved being put to bed, usually for a period of about 3 months. And they weren't allowed to do anything creative. They were absolutely not allowed to write or draw or communicate on the page.
Could you read?
I don't think they were allowed to read.
What did you do? Just lie in bed?
Yeah.
For 3 months?
Well, they were given a lot of insulin as well, so they slept a lot. And they were only allowed out of bed to relieve their bodily functions, and then they were put back to bed again.
That sounds terrible.
I know, it's enough to make you go crazy. And Charlotte Perkins Gilman practically did go crazy. And of course, she fictionalized the experience in her short story, The Yellow Wallpaper.
The famous one where this woman kind of feels like, well, she is going crazy.
That's right.
Weren't there other periods in history when people actually didn't expect to sleep 7 or 8 hours interrupted? I mean, you wrote about people like Dr. Johnson in the 18th century who had these very vibrant nocturnal lives.
Yeah, I think the injunction to sleep 8 hours a night is a product for capitalism. For capitalism to work, you need workers to be awake in the morning at their desks by 9, to do a full day's work, to go home, unwind, and then sleep. But in pre-modern times, and before society industrialized, it didn't really matter. And people would typically have 2 sleeps. So they would sleep as darkness fell, and then they would wake up in the early hours of the morning after a phase of 5 hours sleep, for example, and get on with their activities. And I use the example of Pepys because he kept a diary. So he'd get his hair cut, or he'd chat with friends, or his friend would sit in his bed with him and they'd share a glass of port, or he'd do astronomy.
So people were up and entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
They'd have friends over.
Well, he did. Yeah.
Have you ever tried that? Or has it ever occurred to you, maybe there's nothing wrong with your insomnia? Maybe your body's just trying to sleep in two chunks.
I absolutely do the 2 sleeps now, because I'm not the kind of insomniac who can lie in bed torturing themselves with their own thinking. You know, I get very bored with my own circular thoughts very quickly. So I do get up and I do stuff.
What do you do when you're up?
It varies. It depends how actually exhausted I am. You know, if I'm really, really tired, I'm not good for much. So I sit with the dog a lot. I might listen to music. I might scroll through Twitter. If I'm more awake, I might watch a documentary. I might do some writing. I might get my email, get a head start on my email for the next day.
It sounds like it can be a very fertile, creative time.
Yeah, I find it creative because of the intensity of being awake in the dark. You are in tune, not just to this kind of what I call the nocturnal literacy, this new landscape and soundscape of the night, but also you feel more porous in the night, not just to the external kind of stimuli, but also to your unconscious. So for creative people, I think it's really interesting when you're awake at night and there's less of a barrier between your unconscious and your conscious mind. Because I think a lot of creativity is about tapping into your unconscious mind. And we don't do that in the day because, you know, wakefulness drowns out the noise of the unconscious. And in sleep, the unconscious mind can speak to you.
There are times when coming awake at night, to me, feels like a gift. I know it can be really isolating, but there are nights when I surface out of a dream and it's this beautiful silent time when nobody wants anything from me. And if I can, sometimes I'll try to just go back into the dream. It's sort of conscious at first, but then it kind of merges into some almost twilight sleep state. I can't tell you if I'm dreaming or if I'm imagining. It's a bit of both. Do you ever do that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there are these, I don't know how to describe them really, sort of velvety states where you feel cocooned in wakefulness, as if you're sleeping, but actually you're awake. There are lots of states that are in between wakefulness and sleeping that we experience over the course of a night repeatedly. We don't always remember them, but we go through them, we cycle through them. So I think that there are these very interesting in-between states that we're often not witness to, just as we're not witness to our sleep.
Well, I was struck by your comment that in ancient times and ancient legends, people often went into darkness, sleep, to find truth or enlightenment. For instance, you talk about dream temples in ancient Egypt.
This was something I got very interested in when I was reading about it, which is the idea of having a second sight or a third eye. And that vision, that insight, is actually predicated on darkness. And in Egypt, you would have this kind of temple sleep where you would open yourself up to the night and have these dreams, which were seen as prophetic gifts. So there's a long tradition of associating darkness with insight or deeper sight.
Do you do anything yourself to try to make the nighttime sacred time?
I mean, I don't do rituals like light candles or scents or, you know, make the night ritualized in that way. But I do feel the sort of magic of night when I'm in those quiet states of insomnia where I don't feel perturbed, but I feel kind of at one with the universe. And one of the things that I write about in my book, there's a running theme of cosmicity in it, where because there's nothing between you and the stars, you sort of only darkness, miles and miles of darkness, you somehow feel as if you can reach out and touch the stars. You feel connected. And I don't mean that in a kind of dippy, new age sense. I just mean that in a sense of it's part of the nocturnal literacy, really. It's part of the porousness. It's an openness to our sense of being, our animal natures, if you like.
You make me want to stay awake at night much more.
People have said that about reading my book. They've said, I want to be up at night. I'm jealous of your insomnia.
I'm going to set the alarm for 3 a.m.
I have a cup of coffee at midnight.
Marina Benjamin. Her meditation on sleeplessness is called Insomnia, and she was talking with us from her home in London. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about sleep and how to survive on not quite enough of it. Writer Daniel Pink swears by what he calls a nappuccino, a short nap with a cup of coffee. You might want to take notes on this one.
So I have to ask you about the nappuccino.
Yes. So I was someone who would, in the past, has napped. And I always woke up feeling terrible. My eyes were itchy and my head hurt and I felt groggy. And I also felt deeply ashamed of myself for napping. And I realized I was doing it wrong. What the science tells us is that there is an ideal length for a nap, and it is surprisingly short, shorter than I would have imagined. It's about 10 to 20 minutes. A 10 to 20 minute nap is the ideal length nap. When we nap longer than that, we begin to develop what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling you and I are talking about. But a 20 minute nap gives us a significant amount of restoration without that sleep inertia. For me, I always like to say, naps are Zambonis for the brain, right? We got all of these, like in a given day, all these nicks and scuffs on our mental ice, and a nap, 10-minute nap, smooths out the ice. But you mentioned the nuclear option.
Combine the nap with the coffee. Right?
Exactly, but it's a surprisingly effective solution, and there's actually a decent number of academic papers about this, and here's how it would work. During this period of the trough, and a lot of times we can identify that period because for most of us, it's around 7 hours after we've woken up. So if I wake up, typically wake up at 7, that 2 o'clock period, plus or minus 15 minutes, half an hour, is really, really the low point. So I will go into my office, I will sit in a chair, stretch out my legs. I like to put on noise-canceling headphones, I put those on, and I set my timer for 25 minutes. Then I will have a cup of coffee. I won't enjoy it. I literally will take a cup of coffee, a hot coffee, and I'll put like 4 ice cubes in it and just gulp it down. And then I'll set my timer on my phone for 25 minutes. I can now usually fall asleep in 10 minutes or so.
That's the other trick, is how do you train yourself to fall asleep right?
Yeah, yeah. To me, that's a little bit like meditation. People actually can get significantly better at it through practice. For now, I can usually fall asleep in 10 minutes. So I set my timer for 25 minutes, close my eyes. I can fall asleep. Let's say I fall asleep in 10 minutes. My alarm goes off in 25 minutes. I've gotten that 15 minutes of napping. But here's where it gets interesting. Caffeine takes about 25 minutes to get into our bloodstream. So I'm waking up from that nap, right in the sweet spot. 15-minute nap, no sleep inertia. I'm waking up. I've got the mental restoration. I've got the mental acuity back. I've got my mood restored a little bit, no sleep inertia, and then I get that added boost of the caffeine kicking in at exactly that time. And this is known, and this is not a joke, you said it, this is known in the literature as a nappuccino. And it is the scientifically most effective nap. You can go, listen, folks, go into Google Scholar or any kind of academic database, and you can find some really lovely papers about the efficacy of a nappuccino.
And has Steve Paulson tried it? Not yet. Daniel Pink is the author of many books, including When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Next time you find yourself awake at 3 in the morning, running through your to-do list and wondering if you'll ever sleep again, just remember you're not alone. There are a whole lot of Gen X women who are wide awake with you, women like Ada Calhoun.
So it was 2 years ago during the summer. I was supposed to be working on 3 different freelance projects. I'm the breadwinner of the family, so this was going to keep us solvent for several months. But then one after the other, all the freelance gigs fell apart. My last book had not sold what they thought it was going to sell. We were up, I guess, at that point to like $20,000 in credit card debt. So I was just like lying awake at night, staring at the ceiling, thinking about all the things that I had done wrong married an artist. I should have married a day trader. We shouldn't have taken that vacation. I should never have gone freelance. I was torturing myself, and I was just deeply unhappy. And then something magical happened. An editor at Oprah.com said, my friends and I are all in this weird place where we are in our early 40s, mid-40s, really struggling, and I think there's something going on. Why don't you write a long story about our generation of women? And I thought, oh, you know, yeah, like, four women are sad, like, hurry, someone write a trend story. But then I started looking a lot at Generation X and how bad our luck had been. You know, you look at these numbers, you look at how much less people make now compared to their parents at this age and how much more expensive things like housing and healthcare are. It shouldn't be surprising if we have credit card debt. It shouldn't be surprising if we feel like we're falling behind. If you add worrying about your kids, worrying about your parents who are aging, once you start piling on like that, the fact that any of us gets any sleep at all is kind of a miracle.
Ada Calhoun's revelation that her insomnia, which felt so personal and private, might actually be generational and gendered, led to her best-selling book, Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis. It struck a nerve for a lot of women, including our producer, Shannon Henry Kleiber.
So I wrote the story, and the story went kind of amazingly viral, hundreds of thousands of shares in a couple days. And I started getting messages all day, every day, from women saying that they related to it. You know, the hormones at this age, it's really common to be waking up at 3 and 4 in the morning. And then because of all the finances and all the other things we have to worry about, it's really common to not be able to go back to sleep.
I love the dedication for the middle-aged women of America. You're not imagining it, and it's not just you. I love that. How much is this a book about, hey, you're not the only one?
That's the major point of writing the book. So the book, I really wrote it for all the women and for myself. This book is not for women who are like sleeping soundly and ecstatically happy about all the opportunities that midlife provides. This is really geared toward women who are having a hard time in one way or another and trying to figure out why.
Tell me about one of them that really illustrated what you're trying to get across.
So there was this one woman who was in North Carolina. She was like a contracts analyst. She had a little kid, and her husband made some money, but not a ton of money, so it wasn't like her income was negotiable. And she just said this thing. She said, like, I just did everything right. She had gotten, what's it called, like a useful degree, in quotes. She had gone into a safe field. She had moved to a less expensive city than the one she wanted to live in. They bought a little house. You know, she had just made all of these smart moves. She waited to have children until she felt like they had enough money. And then she found herself with this little kid tethered to this job that she was really frustrated in and just working super hard all day, every day, not really able to fulfill her dreams at all. And just, she wanted another kid, but she felt like there was no way. They just couldn't afford to have a bigger family like she'd always dreamed of. The first time I'd spoken to her, she'd said, can you imagine what would happen if I lost my job? It'd be horrible. And then sure enough, like a year or so later, she did lose her job. And they had to go into retirement in order to keep paying for nursery school. It was just so representative of what a bind women keep finding themselves in, even though they are working so hard, even though they are trying their best.
And a lot of it was she wasn't fulfilling the dreams that she had had, and she didn't see any way of it happening in the future.
Yeah. So that's one thing I try to talk about in the book a lot is how we grew up and the expectations that we as women had for ourselves and that our mothers had for us. So we heard, you can be anything you want, even president. And we heard, don't be a nurse, be a doctor and reach for the stars. And just one thing after the other, a lot of the women I interviewed saying to me that Anjali perfume ad. I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, and never let you forget you're a man.
Give her Anjali, the 8-hour perfume for the 24-hour woman.
I can work till 5 o'clock.
Oh, we can be the 24-hour woman. No problem. We're going to do that. It's going to be great. The reality, of course, is that being the 24-hour woman is extremely difficult.
Anjolie, the 8-hour perfume for your 24-hour woman.
I think you say somewhere in your book that boomers might have been the first to possibly have it all, but Gen Xers were the first to be expected to have it all.
Yes. So one boomer friend of mine, I thought, put it really well. She said that when she started out in the work world and she started doing really well, people were surprised and excited for her. And they thought, wow, look at you go. You're amazing. And she just felt like professionally, everything she got was a win. And then she said with her own daughters and a lot of her daughters' friends, she saw them working so hard and achieving at least as much as she did and getting into corner offices and doing all this stuff. But they never felt like it was enough. They felt like, okay, well, I have this, but I need this. And while I'm doing this, I'm ignoring my kids. They just felt like they were failing by not doing more, whereas she felt like her generation, there wasn't this mandate to do everything.
Ada, I so relate to your book. I'm Generation X. My kids are 14 and 16. My parents are 89 and 87. You can just assume all these different things based on these ages, right?
Yeah.
I work full time. I have a husband. I have a dog. I'm thinking about, you know, the orthodontist and the field trips and the things that build up and they're difficult for us to get through in so many ways. But then I feel really guilty. You know, I feel like I'm lucky. I shouldn't be complaining.
So almost every woman I interviewed began our conversation with some variation of the following. I'm so lucky. I have no right to complain. It's not the depression. There's no world wars going on. They would list all these reasons why they didn't deserve to feel bad. And I think that the question remains like, well, if we're not supposed to feel bad, then why do we feel bad? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really valid line of inquiry, because if we do live in the richest country in the world and we do have a house and we do have family or meaningful work or whatever we have, why isn't it fulfilling enough? Why do we lie awake at night staring at the ceiling?
So let's talk about what can change. What can we do?
Well, I think the first thing is letting go of the expectations that we grew up with, the Anjali ad, and all of those ideas that we're supposed to be doing better than we are. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is people don't talk about perimenopause and menopause nearly enough, and there's not nearly enough research or training around it. Only something like 1 in 5 gynecologists specialize in menopause medicine. And as a result, I think a lot of us are going through a lot of physical distress that if we had better doctors, might not be so bad. So I always tell people, get a good gynecologist. And there's like the North American Menopause Society has databases of people who really know what to do with women in this phase of life to help them.
Because the physical is really, both the physical and mental are part of the sleeplessness. We're waking up, but then once we're up, our minds are running and running,
right,
and running and running.
And it's a feedback loop.
What about managing expectations? You know, the perfect being the enemy of good kind of thought.
I always like that phrase, the perfect is the enemy of the good. I think that's true. So like one expert in generations who I talked to, she said that it used to be our mothers and grandmothers would judge themselves on a couple of things. So maybe it was on how they did at their job, or maybe it was how they kept their house. There were a couple of things that they picked and they focused on. And she said that women of this generation don't pick. They just judge themselves on every single thing. So maybe there's 20 different areas, their bodies and how eco-conscious they are and how much professional achievement they have, how sexy their marriage is, and on and on. And if they're not 10 out of 10 in every single one of those, and nobody is, face it, then they feel bad and like they have to work more at it. And that's why I think you have this boom in January and February of all these self-help books, the new year, new you stuff of like, okay, well, here's the area you need to help, you know, work in, like clean out your closets.
What's different about the male midlife crisis, which we certainly hear more about? I mean, the stuff of countless movies involving younger women in red sports cars. And are we being too quiet about it?
A lot of the therapists and experts that I spoke with, and I spoke with dozens of them, a lot of them told me that the male midlife crisis is very performative. You know, he acts out, possibly, and that women seem to just do it very quietly. they still get the kids to school in time. They still get the PowerPoint presentation done. They still get the, you know, end of year gift cards for the teachers. They still, I mean, they just work so hard all day long taking care of other people. And it's not like they're going to not go visit their mom at the retirement home or not bring their aging aunt groceries or whatever it is that she's doing every day. But then maybe she wakes up in the middle of the night and stares at the ceiling and cries. Or maybe she stares out the window of her car and just stays parked there for, you know, an hour and just feels a few feelings and then gets out and does all the things she's supposed to do. It's much quieter. It's not very cinematic. And that's why I think it hasn't gotten a lot of attention. But I don't think it makes it less real. I don't think it makes it less painful. And in fact, I think it makes it rather heroic of all these women. I think that's why I did the book. We have to honor these women's experience.
Yeah, I found your book to be so full of hope. I mean, some people I've told about it say, oh, that sounds depressing or, you know, lots of complaining. But it's really, it's like this kind of light on this nearly invisible collective angst that so many of us have. And it just feels better to know that other people are having it.
Yeah, I think so. It's better for me. I mean, I will say the last year or so, it's not like I don't ever wake up in the middle of the night still, because I do. But I tend to wake up, look at the clock, it's like 3 or 4, and it's kind of nice to know that while I'm lying there, that there are lots of women that I really like who are out there in the world also awake at the same time. It gives me kind of a feeling of sisterhood.
That's Ada Calhoun, author of the bestseller Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis. She was talking with producer Shannon Henry Kleiber. So if you're listening and you are also awake at night, I hope this hour reminded you that even if everybody else in your home is sound asleep and your neighborhood is full of darkened, silent houses, you're not alone. There are millions of us together in the night. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon Henry Kleiber is the brains behind this hour. She had help from Angelo Bautista, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. And if you are a TT Books super fan, which I hope you are, and you would like to hear more from us, make sure to subscribe to our weekly free newsletter. You'll find it at ttbook.org/newsletter.